You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Brandon Webb, among other things, he's the CEO of an excellent news service, foreign news, defense news, military news, international news, domestic news. It's called SOFREP, S-O-F-R-E-P. He started the Sniper School for the SEALs. Brandon Webb's also written novels about the military. He's all around jack of all trades. And his 2022 predictions came out. And again, SOFREP has people on the ground in 100 different countries. So they're an excellent source of predictions and knowledge of what's happening. And he comes on the podcast to talk about his 2022 predictions. And here he is. So Brandon Webb, you've been on the podcast a gazillion times. The last one was for your novel,
Steel Fear.
Steel Fear. The next one is like Cold Fear cold or fear. Cold Steel.
Cold Fear.
Okay. The third one should be Cold Steel.
Yeah. And we're trying to figure that out because we're on book three right now. We're working on book three.
So. I am so impressed, by the way, that you've converted your knowledge of military and also your knowledge of how to analyze algorithms to basically novels, because you figured out what category you should be writing a novel in. You got a three-book deal, right? And you start churning out these novels that are excellent, by the way. So, and we've talked about that on a prior podcast. We've also talked about, you know, being a Navy SEAL, you set up the SEALs Sniper School, which, you know, the guy that the movie American Sniper is about graduated from that school. And you've written a bunch of books about that. But also, you were the founder and, I guess, CEO of SOFREP, which is foreign policy news, defense news, of course, military news. And what I really like about your news company, as opposed to like every other news company, is that your sources are very real. Like yeah. You have, it's not like you have reporters that, you know, get press releases sent to them and then you write about them. You have people on the ground in 100 different countries because of all of your military and intelligence agency contacts. And they're not just intelligence contacts from the U.S., but from other countries. You have thousands of connections working in every country. And so when you see news, these are things that are actually happening on the ground, which is why I always appreciate every single year. You started in 2012. I appreciate every single year your predictions. They're not biased left or right. They are what they are.
Well, also, I would say this. When I started SoftRep, it was military culture only. We started it was a fun site. I started interviewing my friends, like Chris Kyle, the American Sniper. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was I built this writing team. And what ended up happening was these guys and gals were reading what was happening in Fox, CNN, New York Times. And they're like, they're not getting it right. Like, this isn't happening in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so they would call their friend. And then they would write a story. And then all of a sudden, the New York Times calling me like, who the hell are you guys? And can you work with us? So we've done several pieces on the investigative journalism side with New York Times, NBC, CNN. So it's kind of cool. It morphed into this news site organically. I didn't start SoftRep going, I'm going to have a foreign policy news site. It's just the guys that were writing for the site cared about what was happening in the world because they had served overseas. And so that's kind of how we started out in news. And then I had to figure out, okay, now I'm the CEO of this news site. We can't do satire anymore and people are taking us seriously. So it was a lot of lesson learned on how to ethically, you know, run a news organization. I'm really proud of what we built over the years. And to your point, I think generally people think we're conservative based on, you know, the fact that a lot of the writers.
Yeah, people associate the word military with conservative.
Yeah,
I was about to say that, is that
which
I do not see an ounce of that in your site, left or right.
No, I'm glad because we work really hard at just kind of trying to bias towards the truth instead of spinning it one way or the other. So I'm glad,
and
that shows up that way.
And it's an important perspective because, first off, the military is supposed to be neutral. The president of the United States is the commander-in-chief of the military, regardless of what party he comes from or she comes from. And second is that you really are, and I say you, I mean the military in general and intelligence forces and so on, and SEAL forces, you're an ex-SEAL and all special forces. You are in every country dealing firsthand over life and death, what the political and economic issues are in that country. That's why the reporters are calling you. So it's for a lot of these reasons and for predictions like what we're about to talk about that I really enjoy talking to you about. And I just saw this earlier today and gave you a call and you were available to talk. So I'm grateful for that. But let's get right into it. Like, you know, you started off with, you know, domestic affairs. And obviously the last 2 years have been, I don't want to say eye-opening, but have been very different. Nobody would have said in 2019 predictions, oh, the entire economy is going to be locked down for a year and we're going to have this pandemic. Like, no, everybody who made predictions at the end of 2019 was largely wrong, and that's fine. But now that we've seen all this, we're dealing with, I'd say the main issues internally we're dealing with, other than the polarization, are supply chain issues, inflation, employment issues. And maybe we can start off with those because they're very important in the sense of where the stock market's going, where inflation's going, and how, you know, the higher inflation is, the more political unrest there will be. And, you know, I have opinions on this, but I'm curious what your issues are. And also how we're going to deal with the next 10 variants of this pandemic is going to be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, on the pandemic, I was thinking about it as I was, you know, rereading the forecast for 2022 that the team put out. I was thinking, okay, this is just something we're living with now for the foreseeable future. I think like we're going to have probably a national vaccine pass like they do in Switzerland. I actually have my Swiss vaccine card on an app, but I just can't, like, you think, is this just going to be over and we're going to get rid of the masks? Like, I just don't see that happening. I feel like it's here to stay. Like, this kind of pandemic lifestyle isn't going anywhere. Hopefully we get smarter and it becomes more convenient. But to your point, domestically, it's already created this huge issue of you can't tell me what to do, right? And it's very politicized and it split the country. That's kind of on this issue, which, you know, we're already a country divided.
And let me ask you already, sorry if I interrupt, because there's so many things you cover, like in each thing, like, and you mentioned this in the article that the U.S., even the U.S. government's going to start waking up to the second and third order effects of policies around this. So for instance, what happens when you print all this money? And I don't belong to the same camp that says inflation's mandatory once you print money, but there's also what happens to the economy when you shut down all these businesses? What happens to health issues when you shut down medical care, except for people with COVID? What happens when there's mistrust around some of these issues and so on? So you address that in the article, but when you say it's we're here to stay, you know, do you think that, and I know you're not a healthcare expert, so, but do you think that, you know, with Omicron, it sort of shows that maybe we're mutating towards less virulent versions? I mean, they're more transmissible, but less dangerous than prior variants like Delta. Do you think that could trend towards COVID being essentially a non-issue, just like SARS-1 became a non-issue?
No, I mean, look, I've traveled extensively during the pandemic, and I've seen kind of how the EU is kind of in a similar situation, right? It has these different countries that are member states, and, you know, you have the vaccine, and if you go to Switzerland, where my girlfriend lives, you have to show your Swiss card. I had to go to the Swiss pharmacy and have them verify my New York vaccine, and then you get this, like, national app. So I just, because of the nature of global travel and we're so interconnected, I think I cannot see us putting away the masks and not going to some type of national vaccine proof. And then it's going to be the way it is, because people, they're having challenges with people in the workforce, you know, even though work is trending towards remote where it's more acceptable, you still have people in offices and the policies are all over the place. So eventually I think the United States is going to have to come up with you can't just say, okay, Texas, you do it your way, Florida, you would do it your way. It's like, no, we're going to have to come up with some type of national plan. And it's to travel interstate, you're going to have to get vaccinated and constantly stay up with these different variants. And I think that having this, whatever you call it, app, is just going to be a way of life from now until the future, because these pandemics aren't going away. I mean, it was SARS years ago, and now it's COVID and these different variants. Now, I got Omicron, my family did, when we were in Tulum, just ripped through us. And it was pretty mild, like sore throat, you know, congestion, and a little bit of down energy.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, if COVID ultimately every variant is, you know, there's fewer and fewer deaths, and it becomes like maybe a bad cold or a small flu. And by the way, I'm not saying that's what it is. I'm just saying, if, do you think we'll still have as much seriousness around the issue, or will eventually people have COVID fatigue and just be like, all right, enough with the mandates and this and that?
I think that there is that kind of COVID fatigue. I just don't see it going away anytime soon with an example of being this Omicron, right? It just pops up. It affected me. I almost didn't get allowed to board a plane to Switzerland. So I think, as you know, we've talked about this before, governments are just super slow to regulate things. I mean, look at what's happening in crypto and NFT space. They can't, it's so far advanced. They're just getting around to wrapping their head around regulating Bitcoin and Ethereum. And now you have these crazy NFTs, which is, I'd love to talk about at some point. My son has started a crypto hedge fund, and they're investing heavily into NFTs, which a lot of utility NFTs that play into the metaverse and all this other crazy stuff.
There's a couple of things though. One is, you know, right now there's 10 million jobs open in the US and maybe 7 million people looking for jobs. So that's a really wide gap. I've never seen that before, really, where there's so many more jobs open than there are people to fill them. And it's even greater than that if you consider that not every job is appropriate for every person who's looking for a job. And a lot of that is because of, A, people switched to a different lifestyle during COVID. They simplify their lifestyle and realize, oh, this is okay. And B, nobody wants to work if they feel it's going to be shut down again, or if they're going to have to wear masks all day for the rest of their lives, or, you know, and whether that's right or wrong, I don't know, but I think that's what's happening. And you refer to that in your predictions. So what do you think happens there? Like, and where are all the employees that, that are no longer showing up for work right now?
Probably Tulum.
That could be. Yeah. Because they're simpler. They figured out they could live in a simpler lifestyle and make money in other ways.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a really tough question. It's a smart question to ask and a really tough question to answer. But I think this is, you know, one of the things I challenge my Sean, my editor. I was like, look, I think, no, personally, I believe that we're gonna be into some type of recession end of the year, end of 2022. And it's because this kind of hasn't caught up with us yet, right? The fact that, you know, all these companies are trying to figure out what's happening with the workforce, regulations, insurance is saying some, you know, insurance companies are very smart on this. They're saying, okay, well, you know, you can't bring so many people back to the office. And so it's just all this stuff happening and it just hasn't quite hit yet. I thought we would be in a recession, you know, much sooner than we are now. And it's like the stock market's still going crazy. Crypto's crazy.
It's hard to be in a recession when there is a lot of money circulating because, you know, $1 of money circulates maybe 5 to 10 times, meaning you buy something and the person you give it to, he buys something and on and on. So $1 printed is worth $5 of GDP.
And I also, to your point, I don't know how the government is tracking the employment data because I do know that a lot of people are working freelance, way more freelancers out there, and they prefer to freelance as opposed to becoming a W-2. So I don't know if that's skewing the employment data or not.
That's a great point because, I mean, in 2020, 55 million people were laid off from their jobs. So it makes much more sense for someone as a lifestyle strategy to say, you know what, it's a little, it used to be considered more safe to work for a company, might be more safe to work freelance. And you're right. I do not think the government tracks those numbers as much because it's not the same thing with the W-9s and it's a little harder to track. Everybody does something different.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. I would say this too about it's interesting. I just graduated this Harvard Business School program for entrepreneurs, and I would just grind on the economics professor, who is amazing. But I would say, how come more economists and organizations don't make bets or predict the future? It's hard to find people that are willing to put a little skin in the game and make a prediction. So it's something I'm glad we're doing. The other thing I wanted, it's just totally unrelated, but we are one of the first news outlets to use an artificial intelligence writer. It's we pay for a service. It's powered by GPT-3, which I think is one of the most powerful AI engines.
Yeah.
But you still have to point it in the right direction and edit it like a human writer. But this AI will write an 1,000-word article in about 10 seconds. And it's pretty fascinating. And even I had the conversation with one of the news outlets, the big ones that we work with, and I said, are you guys using this? And they're like, oh my God, no, we're not. We know about it, but I think it's because they're afraid they're going to be out of a job.
So. I gotta tell you something. So I had someone who's been on this podcast a lot, Paulo, I don't know if we've said his last name, so I won't say his last name, but he fed 1,500 of my blog posts into GPT-3, and he said, give me a title. And I said, 10 ways to stop being a loser. And, you know, which is kind of my style of title. Number four, stop reading my blog posts. So it generated the article and that was number four. And it says, stop reading my blog posts. You don't have to read this. I'm writing this for myself. I write it so that I could be honest with myself. But if you want to be honest with yourself, then don't read this. And that's pretty good. I don't remember ever writing anything like that. So it's pretty good capturing, you know, by way of thinking.
No, it's fascinating.
So how many articles does the AI write for your site?
Oh, now probably 5 a week minimum.
That's interesting.
I'll send you the first article we wrote. It's like, could introduce it to our subscribers was, okay, why should you write for SoftRep? And it wrote this in a similar style than I think I can't remember if it was the Daily Beast or one of the news outlets in the UK used GPT-3, but we did similar and we gave it a funny name. We named it TARS after the U.S. Marine Corps robot in the movie Interstellar with Matthew McConaughey. Just to kind of give it some character, and it was well received. People were like, "Wow, this is crazy," and it's kind of cool.
So you do think the government will get a little bit more strict on whatever mandates they currently have? Like, the trend is that they're going, whether, and again, for people listening, whether or not this is correct, right, or wrong that they should do this, you feel that's the trend that is going to be happening?
And look, can you buck the system and live in your off the grid and Texas or Montana? Yeah, but if you're going to function in the modern America, you're going to have to be vaccinated. You're going to have to download the latest, you know, if it's maybe it's state by state or a federal app, like a vaccine app. But even to travel to Europe now, it's for Americans, it's becoming, it's almost impossible to travel unless you're vaccinated, in my experience.
You know, right now America's polarized around these issues. Does this polarization get violent or get more extreme?
Yes, I think that unfortunately, the fact that the U.S. kind of overextended itself the last 20 years on this war on terror, we are fatigued. We have like war fatigue. I do think Biden has made a lot of good choices, but also signaling Putin and Xi Jinping and China that, look, the U.S. is kind of like stepping back, focusing internally, and you're going to see a much more emboldened Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. And I think that in the future, the world in general is going to be a little bit more unstable, which sucks, to be, you know, to put it plainly. And then domestically, we have big problems at home, and we are a nation divided. We've seen just how COVID and the vaccine is dividing us and been highly politicized. So I personally think we need like massive political reform in America. I still just blows my mind that we can bank on our phone, but we can't vote by phone. Like, that's just crazy to me. We're filling in little bubbles, you know. It's just,
what is the outcome of that? Like, what is everybody just going to have, everybody who's against mandates, which is like half the country, it's like a 50-50 thing. Is this going to be just like, hey, you know, buckle up and do this, and there's not going to be any resistance? Or what's the dangers of an increasing trend towards regulation around this?
Well, I think that, you know, I think the regulation, it's people are just going to get to the point where they're just going to have to go, okay, this is just is the way it is. So I don't see that being the fuel that or the spark that ignites this civil unrest in America. What I see is the fact that the income divide in America, especially with COVID kind of accelerating many things, including, you know, industries like telemedicine, it's accelerating the income divide in America. And now we have this bigger gap of the extremely wealthy and the extreme poor. And that's a big problem we have to solve. When you go to I spent a lot of time in Switzerland this past year and seen how they kind of have a pretty good blend of socialism and capitalism. But you can be homeless. Like, I don't even know if there is homeless in Switzerland, but I've seen the street people and they're doing very well. They're riding around with $1,000 bikes. You know? So I do think though that we really need as a country, and it's not going to be solved by government. It's going to be solved by all of us, hopefully, in industry.
Right, because like, for instance, wage controls don't work. Wealth distribution has not been shown to work. I mean, we've been trying it in a 50-year experiment that has only increased the wealth divide. So, and taxing the rich never really seemed to work because, you know, you can argue on one hand, on the conservative side, you could argue less incentives. And on the left side, you could argue the government doesn't really know how to spend any extra. They don't. There's a Laffer curve where the more you tax people, you still don't make more money because people either decide to make less or they find more loopholes or they move to other countries or whatever. So you don't really raise more revenue that way to distribute wealth. So, which brings me to actually, you know, you there is a section here where you say people are going to vote with their feet. So we've seen, and you mentioned this, but, you know, New York, California, and Illinois have lost hundreds of thousands of people. And in order, Texas, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia have gained people in 2021. People are voting with their feet. How much is this going to continue?
Well, we mentioned, you know, people like myself and yourself, right, who are very portable, have liquid assets. It's easy for us to just go, you know what, I'm out of here, right? Flip the switch and we go where we go. We mentioned in the article that now more people who are maybe in the lower income brackets are that have to sell a house or make more arrangements. So this, that kind of initial wave of people voting with their feet is now trickling down to I think a lot more people who are, it takes more planning and preparation for them to move. So I do think that that will continue more and more in 2022. Just more, you're going to see it at the lower income levels, to put it simply.
What about the higher income levels? Because you see, like, for instance, in New York City bankers, they don't have to stay in New York City anymore.
That's an interesting one, because I'm in Young Presidents organization, and I have friends who are doing very well, and they're not leaving the city, because at least in my small group, a lot of it's spouse driven. Their spouses don't want to leave New York. They're like, we love the city. We can still go on our summer holiday. We have the place in the Hamptons. We can go to Europe. So that, at least in my circle, that's largely driven by everyone I know that stayed. It's been because, well, my wife likes it here, the big city. And you and I have talked about this before. It's specifically New York is going through a big transformation. It'll be a different New York in the next decade for sure.
But this is related to the whole country. Like, we've seen three issues really affect the economy in the past year or even few months. One is, let's just deal with them one at a time. So supply chain issues. There's all these boats lining up to get into the country. And I guess because also China now is slow. I don't even know, what are the supply chain issues?
I mean, I'd love to come back to the domestic stuff, because I think we're going to see a lot of changes with the way we police. But to answer your question, that from my experience, the supply chain issues are what people experience, and myself included. I sold a business that had a supply chain, our e-commerce subscription box business got hit massively. And it was because, at least how I was affected, my shipping rates, I had no net terms, it went to net zero. Suppliers, all of our Asia suppliers dried up. So I think now people are seeing this. And I was able to talk to the CEO at Nissan when I graduated the last week of that Harvard program. We were able to Zoom with the COO, and he was saying even Nissan now is looking to go more regional, to have more regional suppliers, to kind of de-risk having these you know, long distance supply chains that are probably going to be continuously at risk. And people realize that, even especially in America, we wake up and realize that we've exported 90% of the drug manufacturing to China. Probably not a smart idea.
So you see that shifting more towards domestic production, or at least diversified among many countries and not just China.
Yeah, for sure.
But at the moment, though,
away from
what
China.
What is the supply chain issue right now? Like, is it because China is not producing fast enough, or like, what are we missing? What's missing in the supply chain link right now?
Well, I've traveled the last 4 or 5 months all over Europe and back to the U.S. And what I'm hearing from my YPO group, and these are, you know, executives of businesses in the U.S. and Europe, everyone's backed up. You had this kind of timeout for a year plus with COVID, where everything just shut down. And now it's like the engine's starting up again. And at the same time, people are trying to hedge and change suppliers, but they're just kind of trying to get caught up. And so you just have, it's basic supply and demand. There's just not enough supply. Everyone will start making masks, and you know, it's like, okay, now how do we get, you know, even luggage, right?
Right. So like nobody bought luggage for a year, and now they need twice as much luggage, but those factories haven't even like geared up for, or a great example might be housing. Yeah. Like it requires lumber to build houses. And for a year, nobody was building a new house. Now twice as many people are building houses, but we don't even have 1X back in shape yet. Yeah. So one thing this is leading to is, okay, well, when there's low supply and even and higher demand, is economics 101 is higher prices. So we're seeing we're seeing inflation based on supply chain, and we're also seeing inflation based on, or theoretically based on, the Federal Reserve, quote unquote, printing more money or borrowing more money. And a lot of economists say, or a lot of men on the street also say, this will lead to higher permanent inflation. And I'm not so sure. Where do you guys stand on that?
I think we're...
Like, do you think the supply chain price increases are permanent?
I mean, look, it's tough to tell someone, you know, as a business, say, this is the new price, have someone pay it, and then go, oh, you know, we're going to lower it. So I personally don't think that the prices are going to come down. I think the inflation is more permanent in nature. But I also admit that we're in the kind of unknown territory, right? Where we're just printing money as the U.S. And in the America is one of the few countries can do it because people trust the dollar. I mean, oil is pegged to the dollar. So I do think what I have heard in my international friends and my business group is that what happens if all of a sudden China has more influence and all of a sudden, you know, the U.S. dollar loses, for instance, if it just changed from the Middle East, they say, you know what, we're no longer going to peg the dollar to the price of a barrel of oil. It's now going to switch to Chinese currency. I mean, what does that do to the U.S. trust and the market?
Okay, but let me ask you a question. Like, realistically, are people ever going to trust the Chinese currency over the U.S. currency?
Yeah, that's that's a great question. I do think that's a big issue. It'd be a really tough one to overcome. But I mean, China's playing the long game, and they can do that because the political system, where in America now we're, you know, every 2 years we're talking about who the next president is going to be. I think that's one of the reasons the U.S. is in a pretty good shape coming out of this COVID situation, is because generally everyone looks up to the U.S.
Right. I think this is the big question so again, there's two issues: supply chain. You know, if there's not enough supply of products and there's demand, prices go up. And that could turn into permanent price changes, or a competition could bring some of those prices down and whatever. You know, another issue is, okay, if prices are up 5% this year, well, last year they were up 0%. There was even deflation a little bit. So, you know, it averages out. But the money printing one is a strange issue, because we printed up something like 30% of all the money in history in the past year. And the big question there is not... question is, can we do that? And I think, like you said, like, you know, people trust the American currency. It's a supply and demand issue. It's not just a supply issue. So if there's demand for the U.S. dollar, we could do it. And the question is, what other currency could there possibly be demand for? As long as there's demand for the U.S. dollar, as long as people are buying U.S. bonds, then we can print money. Now, the second, like you said, as you just said, the second that trust wavers, then there's serious trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, and that may be more of a longer-term thing to think about. But, you know, be thankful we're not a country like Venezuela. I ended up speaking with one of the largest grocery retailers in Venezuela, and they were having to change their prices 5 times a day.
What causes hyperinflation in a country like Venezuela?
Well, I think in the Venezuelan, they tried the print, they tried printing more money. It just didn't work, right? And people have no trust in the currency. And so you end up, you know, with these wild fluctuations. But that's, you know, that's probably a question an economist is more suited to answer.
Well, I think part of the problem is, like, when the U.S. borrows money, people lend dollars. Like we have to return the loan in dollars. When Venezuela borrows money, they probably also have to return the money in dollars or yen or whatever. So part of the problem is when you borrow money in a currency that you don't control, you can get into hyperinflation. But yeah. The U.S., it's a little, that's again, it's a little, you know, a lot of things have to go wrong for the U.S. to A, have to borrow money in a currency not their own, and B, people have to lose faith in the U.S. currency for, you know, that to collapse. So
yeah.
I'm not as much a money supply theorist as some economists are with inflation. Now, by the way, also, people should note, inflation is not necessarily bad for society. Hyperinflation is, like you mentioned with Venezuela, if you have to increase your prices five times a day, that's a severe problem. But since inflation started, let's say we went over the gold off the gold standard in 1971, yeah, America's created the internet, the web, we've sent rockets to the moon, you know, we've built trillions of dollars of wealth. So it's not necessarily a massively bad thing.
And also, like in Latin America specifically, like if you're in Argentina, the U.S. powers that economy. Most people I know, they borrow in the local currency, convert to dollar as quick as possible. Like, and so these Latin American economies are very vested in the dollar as well. And I think that's other places around the world. But again, I don't think it's going in, is at risk anytime soon.
I think in general, while there might be inflation and the supply chain thing is going to take a while to unravel, you do kind of predict that it'll slow economic growth but not trigger a recession, and that in general, the U.S. government kind of survives all of these types of shocks. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I was just talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers, and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. You also predict that in 2022, we're going to see the House and the Senate go Republican, but the president will be Democrat, and that will kind of create, which, by the way, when the president is one party and the House and the Senate's another party, that's been the times of greatest economic boom because it means government can't make decisions, and so capitalism works.
Yeah.
But do you really think that parties will switch in the Congress?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of I think it just occurs naturally, right? You have these swings. Longer term outlook, what concerns me is Trump kind of controlling the Republican Party and what does the next election look like? I think it could be pretty nasty.
Well, does it? So that's two questions. A, does he control the Republican Party?
I think he has a large, it seems like he's controlling a large percentage of the donor base. But I don't know. That's a good question.
Like if Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who's a Republican, and by the way, this is just analyzing from like almost like a game theoretic point of view. If I'm Ron DeSantis, do I kiss ass to Donald Trump in order to get his donors? Or do I say, listen, a lot of people think I did a good job, blah, blah, blah. Some people don't think I did a good job, but I have my own base in the Republican Party. I'm going to go out there and do well in the debates, and maybe I don't even have to raise as much money as people think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing this happen already within the Republican Party. They're trying to kind of go neutral or distance himself from Trump without kind of drawing his ire, right? So the problem is he just has a ton of influence, and now he's got this, you know, I forget what the hell they call it, but they've got this Trump media business, and so it just
is that launched yet or anything? I haven't heard of it.
I mean,
I've heard of it, but I haven't heard it launched or anything.
I think it has, but I don't know what state it is in. Like, I saw the deck on it. I'm happy to share it privately with you, but
that's interesting.
It's it's just the thing is he can make a lot of noise and a lot of unrest seems to follow him. And that's my concern in a country that's still divided, wider income gap, a lot of problems. And then what happens, a lot of cities like Portland, Oregon have gone a long way to defund the police. I do believe that we need a good police force. I also would agree with the sentiment that the culture, a lot of police culture had needed to change. Yeah, I was arrested as a young 20-year-old Navy SEAL. I've been through the system. It's not nice, and I can only imagine someone, you know, a minority going through the same process, what their experience was. But anyway, yeah, it's something that just concerns me looking towards the next presidential election. It just seems like all the dry tinder is there, and it could just go.
So a lot of this also will be related to what's going on in the economies and politics of other countries. So like starting with Europe is like all shut down right now because of Omicron. How much can they do that without their economy totally collapsing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, I mean, the EU has a lot of problems to solve. But yeah, I don't really have a fleshed out opinion on that, other than that. So it has to, like, you can only, especially in most of the EU states, they have big, big social programs, right? They're spending massively. So how long can they do that before they have to kind of kickstart the economies again? That would be my question.
And the EU is not allowed to print money the way the US is. They have to issue debt beforehand. But what about other issues in Europe? Like, for instance, is Russia going to invade the Ukraine?
I mean, look, I've talked about this over the last year. I think what people don't understand is Ukraine is very historically significant to Russia. At one time, Kiev was the capital of Russia, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it's, when you look at how Putin is very nationalistic, you know, if you work for if you have a secure, like, clearance related job in Russia, you quit tomorrow, you can't even leave the country and get a passport, I think, for 5 years, something like that. So he's very nationalistic. When you look at the media constantly feeds to the kind of Russian based population, like, look, America's a mess, look at all the unrest, you have Chewbacca and Duck Dynasty invading the capital. You know, he's constantly like feeding this, you know, how Russia is so good. And so I think, you know, Putin's biggest concern, and we mentioned it in the article, is that Ukraine doesn't become part of the EU or join NATO. And so I think an easy one to kind of, an easy trade would be just for the EU and America to say, okay, look, not gonna allow Ukraine to join NATO, and kind of get Putin to back off. But the thought experiment is, look what happened to Crimea. He just took it and nobody kind of did anything, and it's an afterthought now. And I think the same could be done with Ukraine. I do not think America is going to go to war over Russia just taking Ukraine, which has this historical significance. I think Putin can make a big argument that says, look, this is part of Russia, it's important to our history and our culture, and he could do it, especially with, you know, the U.S. coming off this 20 years of spreading itself too thin all over the globe, fighting these wars. Nothing,
right, like,
nobody
I can't
does
imagine.
Anything about it. Like, what are they going to do
right.
about it?
Will Europe want to do anything about it?
No, Europe, and we wrote an article, actually, Hunter, my son, wrote this article about a study that Rand did with these war games and using artificial intelligence. They war gamed if Putin invaded Western Europe and Europe loses every time. And so Putin knows this, you know, if we're writing about, he knows about this. And so I just think I love Ukraine. I have tons of friends in Ukraine. I've been to Kiev many times. We have an advertising agency we work with out of Kiev. And I just think that if he did annex Ukraine, Europe wouldn't give a shit, to be honest. And America's like shrugging their shoulders, like, we got problems at home. So I do think that it's a possibility, but more likely scenario is what we talked about in our prediction for 2022, is that, you know, Europe and America just kind of back off the whole NATO thing with Ukraine, and that kind of lets things subside a bit. I do know, I don't think Putin has any interest in, you know, following Hitler's playbook and invading Western Europe. But in his kind of what we've seen, how he
how he manages things internally, the annexation of Ukraine is possible and could be a big kind of a big importance thing for him. Because when you look at where he's at in his stage of life, he's in that kind of legacy zone. It's like, what legacy is he going to live, and how is he thinking about his legacy? And that, you know, that kind of plays into it as well.
You know, that's a very interesting way to look at it. Like, okay, he's in this legacy zone. If he invades Ukraine and it causes a problem, that's what he's going to be remembered for. And so the question is, does he kind of have a soft landing here where maybe he builds very tight economic relations with them as opposed to just militarily annexing them? Or does he say, you know, Russia has to be restored to its old glory and basically own everything around it? And does he annex them?
Yeah, no, that's the question. And I've talked about it with my Ukrainian friends, and they're like, yeah, it's a risk.
And what do you think? How do you think Ukraine will respond?
I don't think they could do anything. They can't stand up to Russia's military power. Not a chance. I mean, they're fighting these, you know, the small kind of skirmishes along the border.
Like, what does it mean? Let's say Russia does take over Ukraine. Will the life of the average Ukrainian citizen be worse or not change?
I think so. I think so, because right now Ukrainians have access to the EU. They have pretty much free travel, relatively unrestricted. Now that all goes away. So it's, and look, the problem is, I think if I'm Putin, I'm going to go, okay, this is going to be a problem for me, because Ukrainians have tasted capitalism and freedom. And once you give that to them, it's very hard to take away. And I think that's a big problem that Putin has. And if he were to do it, he's going to have to just lock it down with an iron fist. And they're just going to have to, you know, get real with the fact that they're now, you know, part of Russia.
But like, this is a naive question, but what does it mean for Putin if he takes over Ukraine? Does that mean he gets their natural resources? Or like, what does a country have that they give to their new rulers when they're invaded in today's day and age? I guess he gets their tax base.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go look at tax base. I think largely it's a symbolic kind of play to this nationalism strategy of like, look, we took it back. I'm the president that got basically the territory of Ukraine back inside Mother Russia. And it could be I think it's more symbolic. Yeah, they have some resources, tax base, that kind of thing. But Putin's going to have a big problem on his hands, because a lot of these young, you know, it's like what happened in Hungary after World War II. You know, the people that wanted freedom left. You know, I know. It's actually my girlfriend's stepfather was on the national water polo team, and the moment he could, he jumped ship to Switzerland.
So okay, so now this leads to China. So China, obviously, there's been a lot of tensions around Taiwan. Does China invade Taiwan?
No, I think China is taking a very long, patient approach to Taiwan. I think China gets Taiwan back in the long run, but they just don't have any need to invade. I think they just go, they're waiting very, very patiently. I think they rattle the saber of Taiwan to distract the media and heads of state to draw their attention maybe away from the fact that China has a big housing bubble that they're dealing with right now. And so I think Taiwan,
that's very interesting,
relatively low risk, China invades.
So like, for instance, 31 countries are doing military games around Taiwan right now, including the US, in anticipation of, or at least in warning of, China potentially invading Taiwan. But you're saying that this is kind of a distraction while China deals with its economic issues. Like, their largest real estate company, I guess named Evergrande, is going bankrupt. And what's going on economically in China?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a tough one to answer other than what we know that and can access through our own media sources. But I have friends in China, and they've kind of helped me shape this opinion of, no, China doesn't want to invade Taiwan. They're going to get it eventually, and they know it. They're just waiting patiently. And look, you know, how many billions of dollars does it cost America to go war game in the South China Sea? It's a huge distraction, huge waste of resources. And China just kind of sits back and goes, okay, they're focused over here. Now we can kind of deal with our own internal issues and the optics of it to the rest of the world.
Will they deal with those internal issues? Like,
No, to your point, I think China has a big problem. I mean, they have a massive population, tons of environmental issues, just feeding that population and supplying, you know, just the amount of oil that, and we mentioned this in the predictions as well, is that the fact that China is so, is relying on, you know, external sources for their oil consumption is a problem. And I think China has, as much as the U.S. has, I think, has its own issues around trust with this kind of schizophrenic foreign policy that's happened the last 20 years, you know, China has, doesn't have a good reputation. They've gone in these African countries, said, oh, we're going to build your roads and your bridges and all this infrastructure. Just give us access to your local resources. They come in and they just take, like the Borg and Star Trek, they just take everything, exhaust all resources. And then these governments that had these shiny new bridges and roads, the roads are crumbling because there's been no plan to kind of maintain the infrastructure. And China's like, we're out. You know? So they've just come in and just ravaged these countries throughout Africa. It's one of the reasons why South Africa is never, you know, they're very diligent about preventing the Chinese, you know, from even accessing their coastal fisheries. So China has a big problem. They have a big problem with trust as well.
And what if they don't solve it?
Yeah, that, I think they have a, you know, that's probably what's keeping Xi Jinping up at night. It's like, how do I deal with all this internal stuff that's happening and a, you know, a hungry population, a very poor population, and how do we keep up, you know, with, you know, China's, you know, what I think is their ultimate goal. They want to be number one, and they probably are the largest economy now in the world. But, you know, they've got issues probably you and I don't even can't even comprehend. But, right. Yeah, I mean, look what happened to the USSR, you know, it could go, our model of democracy is not perfect, but it works. People like freedom. I think inherently people want to be free. And that's a big problem for China in the modern age where, yeah, they try and limit the internet and the stuff, but it's very hard. You know, people, the smart people know, can kind of get around it. So I think that's their biggest issue is give somebody, I know I have very wealthy Chinese friends, when given the choice and they have the resources, they don't choose to live in China. They leave. They go buy real estate in New York and Los Angeles, and they get the hell out of China. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's going to be a big problem for China in the future is if and when the population kind of wakes up and says, we're tired of this. That's a big problem.
And on the reverse side, I think India, despite its various border problems, you know, U.S. manufacturing trusts India a little bit more right now, even though there's not really a manufacturing system in India, but, you know, that's one way we'll diversify our supply chain is buying from India and India, you know, Indians are not leaving as much as they used to come to the U.S. for new opportunity. And so, you know, that's going to be an interesting issue in that region. Although, you know, again, it depends on how we treat these countries and how China does and so on.
Yeah, India is an interesting one because you have their defense industry. You're going to see a massive boom, and because now, you know, look at what's happened in Afghanistan with the U.S. pulling out. I think domestic terrorism increases in India because now you have this, you know, well-armed Taliban and backed by the Chinese as well, and so. You know, India's in a tough spot. I mean, it still blows my mind that we have this strong alliance with Pakistan and not with India, because India seems like a pretty damn good partner to me for the many of the reasons you mentioned on the supply chain.
All right, so what are the five things to worry about for 2022 in the world?
I would worry about Russia and Ukraine and how that affects Europe. I would worry about a nuclear Iran. I say this because, you know, Iran has been a known state sponsor of terror for years and years. And when you have this radical ideology coupled with nuclear weapons, that's not a very good combination. So that keeps me up at night. No one's talking about North Korea, what's happening there.
Well, okay, that's very interesting. Well, I'll get to that in a second. But like a nuclear Iran, is that, how possible is that?
I think it's very possible. However, underscore you know, Israel's not going to sit by idly and let that happen. So I, you know, it's like conflict. There could be a war with Israel and Iran. And how does that look?
But I think also that could be why, like Iran, correct me if I'm wrong, they're more Shia and the Arab countries are more Sunni. And so I think that's maybe why there's all these alliances between like Qatar and Saudi Arabia and so on with Israel, is that Israel is the check in the region on Iran. Yeah. So perhaps that's happening naturally.
Yes, but the point is America largely destabilized Iraq. Iran has more influence, pretty much running a proxy government in Iraq. But, you know, just regional stability and the fact that we still are heavily relying on oil coming out of the region. And so what is that, how does that affect the world, right? I don't think the U.S. has an appetite to go to war, but we may just be drug into that conflict, given everything you just mentioned with the alliances. So, but that keeps me up at night. That's a very real problem. And if I'm Iran, I'm going to be a little bit more emboldened, knowing that kind of Biden is looking inward and the U.S. doesn't have a big appetite for a big conflict. So if any, it was a time to do anything, it would be now. But that's probably the number one thing I think about when I think about global stability is what happens if Iran goes nuclear, Israel goes to war, and just kind of like how does the rest of the world look at what's going on in the region? Because it's when you travel enough, you realize it's very close to Europe, right? You know, the Middle East. It's not as far away as people think. What else? It's hard for me to come up with five, but those are the
But that's a pretty serious one. And yeah. I wonder. My gut tells me is that, I mean, Israel's never quote unquote gone to war. They fought wars like when they've been attacked, but they've never really gone to war. Although with Iran, in the past, they've attacked facilities that they felt were building nuclear weapons, and they have an extremely good intelligence force. And now that they have all these alliances with the other Arab nations, my guess is Israel's being relied on as the checks and balance on Iran. And yep. And I think that is a big worry. But my guess is somehow or other that balance holds because of Israel and because of its new alliances with the other Arab nations. I hope.
Yeah. And then I'd say another big concern for me is just civil unrest at home. You know, how does America kind of deal with these issues of, you know, racial tension, social, like economic disparity and those types of things, which are very real problems. Like, you know, we live in a great country and have a ton of, it's a rich country by all means, but we still can't afford to pay. You know, a trip to the emergency room shouldn't bankrupt a middle-class family. And largely the middle class is vanishing anyway, but that's a big problem, you know, healthcare, education, civil unrest.
What's one optimistic thing you think will be 2020? Let's close on a note of optimism.
Yeah, which I like. I am an optimist. Look, I think artificial intelligence, the fact that we do have these problems in America has been very... We have a ton of smart people to kind of figure this out. And the fact that, you know, I'm a member of this Young Presidents organization, it's 26,000 executives globally, and we're all having this conversation about how do we, as industry and business, you know, leaders in business, how do we help solve the problems of the world and the problems of America? So it's no longer, you know, heads of big corporations sticking their head in their own P&L and not giving a shit about the rest of the world. I think and it's why you're seeing now a lot of businesses take up these social causes and environmental initiatives because we know we have these problems to solve, and if government is not going to solve them alone, that industry has to pitch in. So I think I'm very optimistic about that. Having been a parent to Gen Z kids, I'm very optimistic on their approach and how empathetic they are to the world, how my kids all carry reusable bottles. Gen Z is a great generation. And I think with artificial intelligence and the technology emerging around it, the fact that the metaverse are creating, it's like could double or triple the global economy just with crypto and all these currencies. I am very optimistic, especially around artificial intelligence.
Let me, and I know this is not your area of expertise, but let me ask you about the metaverse. Like, you and I, I don't feel like I'm ever going to hang out in the metaverse. Like, who, other than for, like, I don't like things. And by the way, I'm a believer in the rise of things like the metaverse and NFTs and so on, but maybe for different reasons than most. But why would someone use the metaverse other than, I don't like things where the only use is to make money. So, like, what are some real world use cases of the metaverse?
Well,
and it's fine if gaming is the
no,
use case.
No, I think gaming is a top use case. I know guys in their 40s, my age, that are playing Call of Duty for six, eight hours a day. They're in these groups, and that's a form of escapism. They're in this other world, and I think the metaverse. One of the best books that I've read on is Ready Player One. As you know, people are escaping to this world and to live it out. You know, and look, you know, if I could jump into an avatar and hop in my spaceship and go conquer and explore galaxies, that sounds pretty exciting. That might suck me back into gaming.
Yeah.
So I do, and you know, we're seeing, you know, just look at the explosion with crypto, and it's, people think crypto, they just automatically go to Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's like, and the NFT space is crazy what's happening there. And large part of it is metaverse related. There's all these characters that are being, by this NFT character, like this, there's a thing called Astronaut NFT where it's part of this new metaverse that's coming next year, and they could buy the astronaut and they get a piece of land and a spaceship and they can go explore the metaverse. Like, it's just nuts, but it's happening. And you know,
yeah, particularly the interoperability of all these worlds. So like, if someone's in Call of Duty and another person's League of Legends, with the yes. so-called metaverse and NFTs, you could travel from one yep. quote-unquote universe to another. And you know, these games have never had that kind of interoperability. And, you know, now Facebook's argument is that people are going to start using the metaverse for remote work. So you could have meetings in what seems like a real world place as opposed to Zoom.
Which is kind of like the Ready Player One. If anyone wants to see an example, read the book Ready Player One. Because yeah. they go to school in the metaverse, you know. It's just so it's
yeah,
like,
that's a good point.
Which one becomes adopted, you know, there's a couple search engines before Google took over. So which metaverse is going to rule? I don't think Facebook's is. I think Facebook has too many issues around just trust and identity and reputation.
I agree. I think Facebook's foray into the metaverse is just because they're afraid. People don't understand. The metaverse is not one metaverse. It's thousands. And Facebook is basically standing up and saying, no, it's really going to be us, but 5 years from now. So just wait. Nobody should use the metaverse until we're ready. But it's just like you say, with the search engines, you know, there was Excite, Lycos, InfoSeek, all these others, and then Google won. And before Facebook, there was Friendster and MySpace and Tribe.com and GeoCities, and then there was Facebook. So I think they're afraid that technology will pass them by, and they're probably correct about that. But yeah, so Brandon Webb, I think people can find the predictions for 2022 at SofRep.com, SofRep.com. It's one of the few news sources I really trust for myself. I know you guys do a great job. I've been following this for years, and we've been talking about this for years. These predictions were really well thought out and interesting. And also, you acknowledge that predictions are what they are. They're not facts. They're something in the future that we're guessing, but you guys do have a lot of facts and knowledge and experience to support it. And it's hard to say this will happen and this won't, but at least you bring to life the issues that we need to be looking at.
Yeah.
So, and I appreciate that on the website and appreciate your readiness to come on this podcast. As soon as
anytime.
You sent out the email, here's our predictions. I said, hey, come on. And you were ready. So thank you so much.
Anytime.
Thanks, Brandon.